Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello, and what a weekend of sports it was. Congrats to Charles Leclerc for winning the Australian Grand Prix. Congrats to every English Premier League fan, except for Arsenal fans, because we get another seven games of awesome action as Man City and Liverpool drew 2-2. Congrats to the Denver hockey team for winning its ninth NCAA championship in program history. Congrats to the Cleveland Guardians for being tied for the best run differential in Major League Baseball despite being 1-2. Congrats to the Cleveland Cavaliers for clinching the eighth spot in the Eastern Conference playing game, which is at Brooklyn on Tuesday. Do you think your boss, Josiah, might be able to hook me up with tickets?
I think Steve Govett might get hooked up with tickets and throw it right in my face before he leaves the office. So I think that's like, that's the ceiling for what Joe's connections can do for me is a little stick that, yeah, that Steve uses to remind me that I'm a peasant. Love you, Steve.
Of course, congrats to Scotty Scheffler on winning the Masters. This is a Dustin Johnson podcast for obvious reasons, but, Scotty went to high school with Colby Knieys, Owen Seabold, Kyle Massimilian, Parker Alexander, and Case Dostad was in eighth grade when he was a senior. So those guys were probably pretty excited for him, huh?
Yes. Also, is that how you pronounce Charles Leclerc? Is Charles Leclerc?
Yes. Close.
I'm going to take a wild guess and say that he's Italian.
Oh, also close. He is at an independent state in between France and Italy called Monaco, where your boy has been.
I haven't gotten into any of that yet, but should I? Well, out of all the things that you just listed, because I'm not an EPL fan, I'm not really a college hockey fan, and I don't even really know what the Australian GP is, what should I become a fan of?
Yeah, so none of them, because living on the West Coast is the most disadvantageous place to be a fan of European-based sports. So okay. I would just stick to get really into Aussie Rules football, because that comes on at like 9 p.m. Pacific time. So I think that that's like your best wheelhouse. And not only that, not only do you look like an Aussie Rules football player, I think that you'd be able to like go to the bungalow in Santa Monica and say that you were a retired Aussie Rules footballer and like – get hooked up.
All right. After this, I will hit the road and I will report back at 3 a.m.
Perfect. Thank you. We do talk about college lacrosse, and we just watched the number one team in the country beat the number four team in the country 17-9. So let's start there. Are we going to call Jule Senningberg?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. But
maybe. I'll probably shoot him a text or like tweet or something and be like, yo, please just acknowledge this. It can't only be good. So if you're going to be out there supporting your team publicly when you get your dicks kicked in, you have to be on the other side of that. Take that from me.
In College Park, the Maryland Terrapins shot 11 of 22 in the first half en route to a one-sided win over Rutgers. It seems like the only real competition that the Terps were going to face heading into the Big Ten tournament. Keen Khan led the way with four goals and two assists. Eric Molliver had two and three. Jonathan Donville had his best passing game as a Terp with a goal and four assists. But the story of the game was Logan Wisnoskis, who had 3-1, breaking the all-time scoring record for the Maryland lacrosse program. Jared Bernhardt, whose record he broke, was in attendance as the 2017 national championship team celebrated the five-year anniversary of their victory. Nick, I know you were very busy tweeting out what's that incredible HBO show, The Sopranos?
Yes, because Evan has gotten really into it, so now he's kind of like, oh, let's make a million memes about The Sopranos.
So were you able to actually discern anything that was going on in the game, or you're too focused on the memes?
No, well, first off, I have no idea what any of these Sopranos memes mean unless it's like right in your face. So what, we're not getting any ZD? I'm like, ha ha, okay, I get it. I'm cool. Second off, there were two things that kind of came to my mind. One, if Donville is passing like that, this team is literally unbeatable. Like the casuality, And there's not my favorite play in lacrosse is when somebody gets too casual because they think they're too good and try to throw like an obvious no look pass that like sails over someone's head. Donville is casual because it's like he's just that good, and he almost like borderline looked bored out there. He's like, really? You're making it this easy for me? Well, then I'll just clearly make this pass on very high level, high vision, high IQ, high difficulty, high execution, everything that you could ever want out of a feeder. And he's making it look borderline like wall ball in the spring. The second part is like, I just, you know, again, it's easy for me to say, but we were talking about it last week as far as like, as a short stick D middy, you're going to get beat somewhere. You're going to get beat somehow. If I'm D-ing up Logan with Snow, because I'm saying, hey, have your right hand literally all day. Because he just kept doing this move where he was like stutter step and then just tap dance my way to get into my left hand. Now, obviously, it doesn't look like Rutgers was prepared to defend getting beat to the middle of the field or to his left hand consistently. So
that is well said. Not only that, yeah. It also didn't look like Rutgers was ready for the difference between having to slide to a short stick versus having to slide to a long stick when Logan Wisnoskis was getting in the middle of the field with his left hand.
Yeah, and so like that 11 for 22, anytime I see that, I'm like, okay, some of that is just bad defense. Those were the two things that I saw was like, okay, you like go out and get beat by Donville because you need to put pressure on him and make him dodge so that your defense can take a breath and not get picked apart by his vision. You know, I don't know, without getting too into the detail right off the bat here, it's like you kind of get to choose your own adventure as far as like how you get beat. And that's what makes like a lot of the short stick D-middies that might be good in college not pan out in the PLL. It's like, listen, you're not trying to stop the guy. You're just trying to get beat in a certain way. And it seems like Rutgers D was not cohesively getting beat in a way that was within their system.
Yeah, I thought the color commentary from Mark Dixon did a nice job pointing that out when he basically just said they were off balance, which I think is a euphemism for you don't have six guys that are all on the same page in terms of what they all want to see happen. And I guess it's a function of having a bunch of goals scored in a bunch of different ways. So we're talking about it as if this was all Logan Wisnoskis getting to his left hand in the middle of the field. And that happened twice in like a two goal span in, you know, the middle of the second quarter, which was a pivotal moment when it kind of felt like the team lost the rope. I mean, I guess I should say that like they fell behind 3-0 in the first like 4 minutes. So it was one of those games that kind of felt like it was lost from the jump. But more specifically, when, you know, it really felt like after they had gotten their sea legs, they had scored a couple goals, they had like turned it into a game. There was a point at which it was just like, I'm not really sure they can take away anything that Maryland wants to do offensively. And it's not a function of the fact that they don't have the personnel that could do something. It's that you have to be that cohesive in order to pull it off.
Yeah. And I think like, you know, there's a million different ways to, whether it's, you know, cohesive, whether it's balanced, whether it's whatever it is, but every Rutgers approach specifically on defense, I was like, you're kind of giving up everything. And the way that I describe it to high school D-middies, and the way that it was described to me by Coach Byrne was like, it's not where you get, or it's not if you get beat, it's where and how. And I even distill it down even further. I'm like, I'm not even trying to stop the ball. I'm just trying to guide him down the alley. And I would rather give up an S dodge than get toasted to the middle. So I agree with you, and I think that like Rutgers' approaches were a reflection on either lack of scouting preparation, lack of cohesion on what you're trying to give up. But I mean, honestly, yes, of course, this Maryland offense is ridiculous, but when you go 11 for 22, it's almost when you're not, you know, one of the bottom rung teams and another team goes 11 for 22 on you, 50% of the blame is going to be on the defense just as much as you need to give 50% of the credit to the offense.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to somebody who was in attendance. We're going to call Kevin Brown, who I believe is actually still in the press box in Maryland Stadium.
Closing this up.
You're still in the press box, by the way?
I am.
Yeah, Grinder. Grinder of the week. Love to see that.
Probably pay me the big bucks, Nick.
Terry, we need to have a conversation after this episode, but thank you.
About the size of the Bucks or about your poll votership?
Next question. I need to talk to my lawyer.
Kevin, you were in Maryland Stadium for the Terps win over Rutgers. To what do you attribute the outcome?
Well, obviously the story of the game was Logan Wisnowskis and his career points, but it's got to be Luke Weirman at the faceoff stripe. He put up another casual 75% day from the office, casually getting the ball to Maryland's offense, who can really just do what they want when they want. As Rutgers coach Brian Brecht put it post game, when you play make it take it with this Maryland offense that's playing this efficiently and converting on 40% of its shots coming into the game, I mean, look out. You know, it's going to be a rough going for the Rutgers defense that's really unchanged from a year ago. So
there's nothing I hate more than giving faceoff units credit for a big game.
But
so let me shift the narrative and try to ask one question. I think Rutgers wasn't a cohesive unit in the sense that they almost didn't know they looked like how they wanted to get beat, whether it's Wisnowskis getting to the middle of the field, whether it's Donville shredding them with his hands and his eyes open. If you had to pinpoint something that Rutgers could have done better on defense, what was your take?
Well, it's a good take because they really didn't force Maryland to do anything they didn't want to do. I think they struggled mightily when you'll have a guy like Kyle Long come dodge down the alley, or Jonathan Donville down the other alley, and they pass it so quickly to the guy at X who's already halfway up the wing that they really – I'd say their head-on-a-swivel usage is – could be a little bit better, maybe. the Maryland ball movement is just insane, as we all know, but seeing this offense hum on all cylinders is it's something else. I don't know how you defend it, really.
What I want to see is what happens if Keegan Conn isn't able to get to his spot with regularity, because the aspect of this offense that they will acknowledge is that there aren't a ton of guys who are going to run past you. And specifically, there aren't a ton of guys that are going to run past a long pole. Now, dodging off the catch, dodging with the defense spinning, all six of them are going to be able to be triple threats, right? In terms of dodging, passing, and shooting. But in terms of the defense is set and I am going to dodge a long pole, they have, it seems, very clearly designated Keegan Conn as the number one option. So I want to know what happens when he is not effective. And we haven't seen it yet. So I guess, like, it's a long way of asking. This team's kind of on a track toward, if they're going to win a national championship, they're going to have to do it by going undefeated. And it hasn't happened since 2006. Do you think that they're capable of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at early in the season, Conn really didn't assert himself like he's doing currently. And you look at the unassisted goals he gets these days, and it's still an early offense when the defense isn't set. I don't know. I don't really have an answer to give you for how you stop this Maryland offense, or you look at their defense and – that's a menacing defensive group as well. So,
do you think? Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say the odds they go undefeated are quite high if they don't beat themselves.
Nick, do you think this looks holding like a team that can win a national championship by going undefeated?
Do I think that?
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you something. Is holding this firepower Maryland offense to 11 goals, would you say that that's pretty impressive?
I don't know. It depends. Who did that?
Well, let's talk about it for a second. Notre Dame loses a 2 by Maryland, and this is back when we were pranking people and pretending that we sucked. So even when we were pretending that we sucked, we lose to Maryland by two. I just tweeted out, but if I'm Maryland, I'm literally shaking in my stupid Maryland turtle boots.
And they are boots because they're those highlight cleats. Did you ever wear those? Because you guys were in Under Armour school when you were there, right?
Yes, but if you recall, I had feet that were too short and wide. I have like cinder block feet. So I had to get defensive lineman shoes that were bright pink.
Well, imagine if Jake Taylor played too.
Yeah, game. Well, listen, Jake, the number one thing Coach Corrigan can do to solidify his legacy is recruit more kids from wherever the closest to Wheat Ridge is. But yes, I did have to wear pretty pink cleats. They were like the breast cancer awareness ones, and so I had to use that one. But
so,
anyways,
so you're like, are you like a double E? Are you just a straight New Balance like citizen when you're not getting your shoes for free from a global multi-sport brand?
Pretty much.
504 like, straight. They might as well get it tattooed on your right shoulder.
Yeah, that, and it's like my feet are wider than they are long. I have like tuna cans. Anyways, let's get back on track here. Yeah, I think Maryland's going to run the table. I don't want to admit it, but I'm pissed off about it. But
okay, I don't.
Who do you think takes him down then? Penn?
So,
in overtime?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't – I'm just a field guy at this point. So I think Yale is the second-best team in the country. I think Georgetown – has the potential to be the second best team. I think Georgetown is so far away from their ceiling on the basis of their injuries and how well they've played, et cetera, et cetera. Virginia is such a mystery, right? Like, there's so much about this season that feels familiar to last year. Loyola feels the same. Notre Dame didn't struggle like they are or like they did a couple weeks ago last year. So, like, I guess my point is that I don't know who's going to beat them. I don't think any team can go undefeated and win the national championship anymore. I'll shave my head. If Maryland wins the national championship, I'll shave my head. If they go undefeated and win the national championship.
All right, and if they lose, I'll shave my head.
You're on.
Okay, all right, you're on. Game on.
And I'll grow mine out if they don't win it. Perfect.
Kevin, what was it like being in the building for the 2017 celebration?
Well, the celebration was kind of muted. They kind of put the – they had like a – what's it called? Like a youth game going on at halftime. And it's like, oh, by the way, our five-year anniversary of the 2017 championship is going on. So
huge missed opportunity not to have Colin Heacock and Matt Rambo out there playing with the youth game, because that would have been unbelievable electric content.
Yeah, get a couple brews with them. They'll be
they
they'll
took
be
care of themselves
all those little kids.
Yeah, good right. Kids. Buzzing.
Opportunity.
Well, so here's what I'm curious. I feel like every record is about to be broken. So Snaukis overtakes Bernhardt, and then, you know, Chris Gray is right on the verge of doing it. Asher Nolting. Maybe this is a question for both of you. What am I missing where I was like, oh, these records aren't probably going to be broken for a while, and then 2021 rolls around. It's like, hey, everything that you know is going to be broken by the end of the year. What changed?
Well, then the shot clock came in, and then somehow a lot more goals.
Are we all blaming the shot clock? Like, is that just what we're doing?
No.
I don't think blaming's the right word. I'd say it's a good thing that there's more offense.
I also don't think that it's the sole reason, because scoring is up, and that is partially, probably, and by partially, like the majority, like 60% attributable to an increased number of possessions. But efficiency is also up. Now, granted, there's an argument to be made that efficiency is also up because of the shot clock. Basically, that coaches were their own worst enemies in terms of offensive scoring, right? Like, they, if they had just let you guys play, you would have scored more in the pre-shot clock era. But I also think that there's a function of, this is going to sound weird, but basically, like, a less widely distributed offensive production among the top 9 or top 12 offensive players, meaning that, like, in, say, the, you know, 2010 to 2016 range, if you looked at a typical box score for a 12-goal game, you know, 12 goals, 8 assists, 20 points, and say two of those points went to a long stick midi or a faceoff guy, you had 18 points distributed among the offensive players, you know, you would typically see five go to your number one attackman, and then it would kind of trickle down from there. And what has changed is that, you know, now there's 13 or 14 goals being scored, and there's 22 or 23 points being produced. And so, like, 6 to 6.5 are going to your number one offensive player. And so that's why the number one offensive players, they're not playing that many more games. And that's one of the things that's kind of, like, getting under my skin relative to the – this is not solely a function to the additional year of COVID eligibility, which a lot of people are trying to blame it on. It's a function of the way that the game is being played, and that is a function both of the shot clock and the shortening of benches primarily, and how much – the ball is running through one guy's stick more frequently.
All right, so I'm just going to say it was because when I was playing defense, defenses were way better, and then I'm going to be like, oh, you know, back in my day, we played real defense. Get off my lawn is what I'm hearing.
Love it.
Should we see Matty Ice Kavanaugh not selfish enough on offense?
Yeah. Narrative? We were too humble back in our day. We could have broken every record.
Kevin, you've got to get home. We appreciate your time on the tailgate. If you don't head home, you might as well just head out and join the Maryland tailgate, because I'm sure they're having a great time.
Oh, I might.
Moving on. Jacksonville 13, Richmond 11. In a game that wasn't as close to the score, the Dolphins go to 10-2 on the year by turning a 5-4 lead into a 12-5 lead thanks to six goals from seven different scorers in the second and third quarter. They were led by four goals from Mitty Tyler Corpora, who is a grad transfer from Hartford. He's listed at 5'6", 150 pounds, and he made up for the absence of Jeremy Winston, who scored four goals in the win over High Point and missed this week due to injury. Story of this game, though, was the Jacksonville defense. Richmond put up 17 goals in a win over UVA last week. The Dolphins held the Spider to one goal in a 20-minute stretch that broke the game open when they were going on that offensive run that I just referenced. Colin Hinton guarded Dalton Young, and the Dolphin defense short-sticked Ryan Lanchberry. He held Young to one goal after having held Asher Nolting to one goal last week. Lanchberry finished with four goals, but you can't argue that it didn't really work. So there's a lot to unpack here, but the first thing I want to jump into, Nick, is that this is a kind of a program win. And last week you talked about how the win over High Point would upset the recruiting balance. And then you revisited that topic on the post game, and Evan compared Richmond to Michigan, which, as incredible and insane as that comparison is, one of the things that it definitely underscores is how different Jacksonville is to both Richmond and High Point, as well as a bunch of the other programs that they would potentially be recruiting against. And so for me, what's really interesting about this is, like, not necessarily what it means for Jacksonville on the recruiting front, but more so on, like, a program development front. And the biggest thing is just this year, right? Like, you can't define this team's ceiling. Like, they are 3-1 against RPI top 20 teams, and they have another win over High Point, who's RPI 27. Like, this is a bona fide good team, and now they have proven it. It wasn't one hot streak in early, you know, mid-February through early March. Like, they then kind of regained that level in early April, and I think they deserve a lot of credit.
This is interesting because it's starting to solidify a lot of previously held beliefs about, like, culture, we'll say. Because I'm a pretty big Galloway fan. Just in general, I think he's a pretty good dude. But also, like, even as far as, like, the recruiting things, like, yes, I kind of previously had lumped Jacksonville, Richmond, and High Point all into the good but second tier. And now I'm really starting to think that, like, Jacksonville is gaining momentum more so than Richmond and High Point into becoming a solidified, bona fide top 10 team for the next couple of years to come. Like, if I had to choose between those three teams as to who's going to crack the code, I would put my money on Jacksonville because Galloway's young. And I think in stark contrast to what we were just talking about with Rutgers, What I really like is their ability to execute a game plan. You were just talking about short-sticking
Ryan Lansbury.
Yeah, and yeah, he finished with four goals, but again, like, you can't discredit and say that it didn't work. And it takes like a full team to buy in. And again, a lot of what I kind of go by is like the difference between college and pro. Like, there are still college schemes and there are pro schemes where the pro schemes are like, oh, this isn't going to work. Like, we, you know, let's just not do this. Let's just scrap this. So to kind of take a bold move and have the entire team bought in and able to execute it is the difference between bad and good teams and good and great teams. It's a testament to Galloway's coaching. And like, the locker room with him coming in and playing music and everyone going nuts. You know, this team is just on the up and up. And I mean,
they're the vibe champions of 2022, no doubt.
And it's not even close. And, just speaking anecdotally for a second, like, there's kids that I've been trying to talk to Galloway about that, you know, I think are potentially deserving of a Jacksonville last year spot. And now this year, it's like, oh, well, no. Now we're getting interest from kids that wouldn't answer our phone calls, you know, mere months ago. So, you know, I think I'm seeing in real time a bit of a changing of the guard.
Yeah, so for me, you know, the campus, just the aesthetic of the campus, and I've never been to Jacksonville, so I don't want to, like, speak out of turn, but reputationally, I have been to Richmond, I have been to High Point. They're incredible places. So that's one thing. The second thing is that, like, the nature of being in Florida, right? Like, you're just going to appeal to a different type of individual from the standpoint of, like, weather is going to be important to them. And that's a great thing. Like, that's an asset that you have to figure out how to play. But I talked to John a few times over the course of the last 2 years, leading into the 21 season and leading into the 22 season, when, you know, they have posted social media graphics calling themselves Transfer U. And it's not to sell short the players that they have brought in that have contributed from freshman year on. I mean, you know, Jackson Intrieri is a freshman ex-attackman who has been fantastic for them. Tucker Garrity is a middie who is awesome. Jeremy Winston is, you know, an all-time program level player. Like, these are four-year guys that we're talking about. But, you know, at the same time, whether it was the Mitty that we just mentioned as being kind of the differentiating factor in this victory, or whether it's Luke Milliken, a goalie who transferred from North Carolina, like, or Max Walbaum, who is their offensive leader, they have created a culture where, and this is the part that's so interesting to me from the standpoint of how sustainable it is, because there is, on the one hand, promoting competition, meaning that the only thing you need to do in order to assure your job, your playing time, is be the best that you can be. But there's, if you're a junior or senior, you can be pretty confident that the incoming freshman is not going to be better than you. But what you can't be confident of is that, you know, the transfer from Notre Dame who's never played before isn't going to be better than you. And so then you get into this kind of push-pull of, should I proactively look for greener pastures because I'm going to be threatened by the opportunity to play if you're the type of player who hasn't gotten on the field yet? And that is the balance that it seems like he has struck, that Rutgers, I think, has also struck, that is so tenuous. And I think coming away from last year, particularly because of the narrative that was developed around Duke, where, and I think this is a lot of playing the results, like, the transfers didn't work because they didn't win the national championship and they were supposed to have the most talented roster because of the transfers they brought in. And then after the semifinal loss, John Donosky made comments that kind of felt like he was supporting that idea. Like, that creates this notion that if you try to build through the transfer portal, I read an article in an interview that Dabo Swinney did this week, where basically he just said, like, that's never going to be the model that we're going to take to building our roster. Like, we'll plug holes, but we're not going to build our roster through the transfer portal, which, first of all, I kind of find to be a disingenuous take because it really is just talking about a function of degree. But I think that's kind of what we're talking about as well when it comes to Jacksonville, is that it's always a function of degree. And if you can manage the way in which those degrees implement themselves in your team. And you're not alienating the guys who get passed over. They remain bought in. They understand that new guys are entering the program because they are going to make us better. And then it gets borne out in the results. And, you know, the disgruntled ones are proven to be invalidated by the fact that there are better players producing on the roster. And the guys who are on the team looking around and saying, like, you're our fourth MIDI? Really? Like, we're not going to win the SoCon if that's the situation. But now he's the seventh MIDI and he's been your friend for 3 years and you love him. It's just a function of, like, the fact that you know that he wasn't going to be able to fill that role, but he can fill the role that he's in right now. I can see a scenario in which it works. And obviously John Galloway can as well.
Well, and I think it regarding like transfers and recruits, I think that it's halfway sales and halfway like, you know, a big smoke and mirror show. Because outside of the teams that have just been able to say like, hey, our team's sick and we have unreal academics, which takes away a good amount of players right off the bat. Like,
Nick talking about Notre Dame's admission standards. Boo-hoo.
Believe me, I am. It's like, yeah, it's again that saying, the fact that they let me in is the biggest smear on the academic standards at Notre Dame. But like the Dukes, the Virginias, the Harvards, the Yales, the Princetons, you know, all that, you know, Jacksonville is really building an interesting narrative that to an extent Richmond has a little bit, High Point has a little bit, but a lot of these other programs aren't going to be able to point to hardcore evidence. So when Galloway is calling a recruit and saying, we have a culture here that works. Here's what we're doing. Here's why we're different. And here's how we're approaching it. Here's the balance of transfer. So it's like, if he's talking to a transfer guy, he can point out two examples and say, you are coming here to be a Jacksonville guy. You know, I'll contrast it with Duke, actually. You know, I feel like Duke, which we'll talk about them getting slapped around and borderline mercy ruled in a little bit.
One goal game.
But I feel like right now, as a player, if I'm getting recruited, you know, I'm thinking Duke is a lot of individuals and the best players play. Brennan O'Neill's going to play, Nekhai Montgomery's going to play, and you just have to go out there and ball out to get yours. And I think in contrast, the narrative that's out there talking to people in the lacrosse community, to college, you know, well, actually, I don't talk to too many college players, but guys who watch college lacrosse, it's like, this Jacksonville team believes in something bigger than the history of Jacksonville lacrosse, and it is not a group of individuals. And whether or not that's true or not, the smoke and mirrors and building that narrative is going to pay off monster dividends for transfers and for recruits, and you kind of get to build your own pathway in a much more cohesive way because people are buying into your program, not buying into the clout and to the, you know, God forbid I say lacrosse fame for playing for a blue blood.
This is a perfect opportunity to talk about Syracuse.
Yes, yes, let's go.
So the Orange lost 14-12.
Embarrassing.
At SUNY Albany on Thursday. The UAlbany Great Danes then turned around and lost 16-7 at UMBC on Saturday. The Orange host Cornell this afternoon in the Carrier Dome, and if they win, this conversation could sound real dumb. But the Syracuse team that's been taking the field the last 2 weeks hasn't been that good.
They're bad.
John Galloway is an alum, and there were conversations about whether or not at some point he will lead the Orange. Nick Osello, your thoughts?
In my perfect world, here's what happens. I think that Galloway stays at Jacksonville and builds them to like their first Final Four appearance before leaving. I want to see him accomplish more at a Jacksonville before he gets poached. What I think, and tinfoil hat Nick is coming on here, Terry, so just bear with me. I think that there's this pendulum swinging where lacrosse is just starting to hit terminal velocity, where if you're a PLL player, if you're you know, a good coach, if you're a good guy, if you have a
college. If you're a PLL player, sign for 1 year or 3 years?
1 year. Why you would sign for three, I don't know. That's Oh, I have so many thoughts on that. But I think hopefully here's what we see. Wall Street is not nearly as fun as coaching lacrosse. I think we all know that, but Wall Street obviously makes you much more financially sound, as does any other real career. But I think there's going to be this pendulum where lacrosse is just getting big enough to say, like, hey, we're not going to be rich, but we're going to be living more comfortably than we could have the last couple of years, whether it's camps, whether it's PLL contracts, whether it's whatever. I want to see Syracuse snipe a guy off of Wall Street. The number one guy that I can think of is a guy like Eddie Glazner. I know for a fact he's not loving Wall Street, and he loves lacrosse, and he loves coaching. I know his depth of knowledge is better than damn near anyone else on planet Earth. I know he's a good coach. I've coached with him personally. So in my perfect selfish world, Jacksonville retains Galloway, and he builds something special and a marquee win, whether it's the Elite Eight or Final Four. You know, he makes a deep run before he gets poached. I want to see Syracuse take a chance on someone like Eddie Glazner or another one of these Wall Street guys who aren't that much fun and really set a trend of like, okay, we know you have work ethic. We know you have depth of knowledge. Let's build this into our system because, Terry, if I'm being honest, I think the older the coaching staff is, the less connected they are. And I think to have someone who has played recently pays off monster dividends for building a healthy and productive and buy-in culture of what the coaches are saying and the coach-player relationship. End rant.
So there's two sides that take, one of which is very hot and one of which is not cold, but pretty cold. So the idea of youth equals good is a cold take. Like, that is manifesting in college and professional sports all across North America. So that's not a shock. The idea of bringing in somebody from outside of coaching altogether, not going to happen at a program like Syracuse, but what about Eddie Glazner becoming the head coach at Jacksonville John Galloway takes the Syracuse job?
Wait, sorry, I was screaming in my own head. What
about the Galloway job? Yeah, so all right, so let's just say Galloway gets the Syracuse job and Jacksonville is searching. Why wouldn't they try to tap somebody like Eddie Glazner? They're the type of program that needs to go away potentially from the beaten path. I mean, which they kind of did with John. Like, you know, he was really young when they hired him.
Yeah, and I think that, like, in a way, that almost is enough evidence to take a chance on someone. And first off, like, I think it's very easy to overthink, like, I'm trying to say this without sounding like an elitist dick, but if you played at a high level, I think that there's a certain credibility and understanding of team dynamics that you ascertain if you didn't. Now, I know everybody points to Bill Belichick being the best football coach. I would argue that lacrosse is just a little bit different because you have to incentivize lacrosse to buy into the culture more so than you do football because the financial payoff for football and the socioeconomics just dictate that everybody there is giving it their all to try and make it. And I don't think that that's the case. So you need a younger guy that is still connected and understands everything. Again, in my perfect fantasy, it's Galloway doing something that shifts the paradigm of lacrosse out of Jacksonville. Syracuse realizes that they can't get a young guy like Galloway. And I think the coaching experience, call me crazy for this take, is less important than knowledge of the game. And I think that, again, a guy like, to use two of my friends as examples, Jack Neer and Eddie Glazner, I think those guys would be unbelievable defensive coordinators for the PLL and any top college program. If Notre Dame signed Eddie Glazner tomorrow, I'm popping a bottle of champagne. And, you know, I think that that should, at least I should apply that same line of logic to Syracuse. So I'm biased, but honestly, like, if I'm playing for someone, I would rather have it be a younger guy that knows the game, that might not have the coaching experience, but has like the recent playing experience, so he understands what everyone's going through, as opposed to the long-standing legend of the game that might not be as young or as relatable.
You do not want a Notre Dame alum coaching Syracuse. There's no way that you want that emotional torment. Yeah, but having to potentially
cheer for them. If I want that, so that when Notre Dame wins,
you want it so that when Notre Dame loses, you have some sort of like, you know, clout or cover over which you don't have to soak in the shame of the loss.
Do you realize?
Yeah, well, we only gave you our guy. That's what we lost.
Take win-win. Either Notre Dame made Syracuse better, and everything Syracuse has ever accomplished is because of Notre Dame brilliant minds, or Notre Dame wins. I mean,
it's an emotional hedge. All right, yeah. Moving along to our favorites, basically the Wall Street Farm System. Brown 12, Penn 10 in Pennsylvania. I am rewatching this as we record because I had it on the second screen as I was watching Jacksonville-Richmond. Don't feel like I absorbed a ton of it, but I do know that Penn jumped out to a 5-0 lead and Brown scored 7 of the next 8. The game was really decided around the 5-minute mark of the third quarter when Devin McClain scored 2 goals 45 seconds apart. The second coming on man up. It gave the Bears a 10-8 lead that they never relinquished. He finished with 4 goals. Ryan Ogavin had 2 and 2, as did Reed Machete. Trevor Yabo-Cody had a goal and an assist, 5 ground balls and a cause turnover, and Connor Terrio had 13 saves. Are you familiar with these two guys, Trevor Yabo-Cody and Connor Terrio? Do you know what they look like on the field?
I know, so I just say TYK because I'm like, oh, I'm going to butcher that, especially yeah. with a little mezcal.
TYK is cool. That's a great, great nickname.
Yeah. I was like, I can't believe it hasn't really been picked up yet, which is, you know, kind of a bummer. Less familiar with Connor, but I love it. These are two football players out there forcing their way into the lacrosse world, and they're like, okay, I'll play football but with a lacrosse stick. I love these guys. Two of my favorite. Well, actually, I can't say that about Connor. I'm just kind of lumping him in with TYK, but God, it's fun. It's just fun to watch.
You got to get eyes on Connor Terrio. This kid needs to be on the cover of Inside Lacrosse. It is unbelievable. Just the like peak of human masculinity. The Brown D held Sam Hanley to 1-10 shooting and Dylan Gergar of 3-12. Jamie Zusi won 13-24 faceoffs and Patrick Bergenshaw made 17 saves. I mean, to me, you know, and again, at this point, there's 10 minutes to go in the third quarter. It is 8-8. And I haven't seen a ton of bad Penn offense yet. But when you kind of dive into the box score, it's pretty clear that like that is the end of the field that let them down a little bit. This is the result that shakes up the Ivy League. At this point, I think you kind of parse out the standings a little bit and you say Yale, Princeton, Cornell are in pretty good position. And then Penn, Brown, and Harvard are fighting for that fourth spot. Harvard beat Brown. Brown beat Penn. Harvard heads to Penn on Saturday in a game that I feel like is going to give the winner the edge in that fourth slot.
Very much so. And this is almost what we needed as far as like a little clarification, because if Penn wins this game, I get way more worried about Notre Dame's position as everything I think of goes through South Bend. So my question to you, I think you know this Brown team a lot better than I do. How much of it is running and gunning? Because I saw like it doesn't seem like they do like very great formal 5-on-5. Damn NLL getting into my mind. But this is a team like, so they went 3 or 4 on man up. And I feel like, you know, they're kind of always running and gunning a la the ghost of 2016 Brown. Is this a team that just kind of beats you between the lines and can kind of, you know, scrum it up and almost difficult to prepare for because it's such like a transition and unexpecting attack?
Okay.
So, you go down 5-0, it's like you got to have a little bit of that, I would think.
No, they went down 5-0.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess like from the standpoint of like they were an all or nothing offense at that point, like, yeah. No, so as you were asking me that question, they cause a turnover on their own end. They get the ball out of their zone very quickly. So in that aspect, I would say that they run and gun. I don't think that they are extremely efficient or proficient in terms of transition offense. And I think that was also illustrated by the long stick midi number 39 trying to face dodge somebody about 18 yards away from the, or like 2 yards in from the top of the restraining line. And then as soon as he got like the space that came off of the hitch, just completely got backchecked and lost the ball, and then Penn got the ball back. So
classic.
Yes. The answer to your question is I reject the premise on both fronts. So the first being
Jesus,
the idea that
sorry I even said anything.
No, it's just I don't fault you, I fault everyone. Like the whole world thinks that Brown, because in 2016 they did play really fast. They think Virginia plays fast because the Virginia coaching staff was that coaching staff. And here we go. We got TYK immediately legging out a clear. I mean, you know, they were across the midline with like 74 seconds left on the shot clock, but they didn't turn it into offense. And again, this is a sample size of two against Penn. I'm not like – I've watched them play seven halves at this point, and I haven't seen anything that was like, this is a really good team in transition, but – I will say that whole notion of they, from a clearing standpoint, want to get the ball out of their own end as quickly as they can, that is true. And I thought you saw that in the second half against Harvard as well. And it was one of the things that kind of put them in position to potentially win the game for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is, and I think you saw this in the Harvard-BU game as well, it just put Harvard from a what are we doing with our midfielder standpoint. All right, sorry. Again, Conterterio. Absolutely hilarious. They were just in a 10-man ride. He was trying to cover the guy in the coffin corner. Penn throws the 70-yard clearing pass. He catches it and catches Terrio in that real, like, kind of no man's land where he's, like, 15 yards away from the goal but not able to, like, run back and defend the shot. So right. The offensive player, who's a lefty, is, like, faking as if he's going to take the shot. And Terrio's just like, I'm going to play goalie right here. He was, I'm not exaggerating, 7 yards outside of the crease. He was roughly 11 yards away from the goal line, and he was just in a normal stance trying to – it was awesome. Like, this guy is an electric factory. You have to watch Brown play just to watch Conterterio play goalie. It's unbelievable, dude.
I you know what? I'm going to do a rewatch. I'm going to – when I say rewatch, when I mean watch for the first time, full game. And – all I'm going to do is just keep an eye on him because that explanation like makes my heart happy.
All right. Real quickly to wrap up the rest of the Ivy League, Cornell blottoed Yale. Shout out to your friends. Sorry about that. I believe they were up 10-1 at one point. For me, this
Harvard,
was a,
not Yale, right?
Your friends at Harvard.
Correct. Because you said my friends at Yale, and I said, don't insult me like that. Cornell blottoed Harvard. Let's get the credit right.
I believe they're up to 10-1. This is a big win for the Big Red from the standpoint of bouncing back from the injuries, specifically to Aiden Blake. J.J. Lombardi had been hurt against Ohio State, so that's like, you know, almost 2 months ago at this point. But now they're down two of their top six middies, and they're still able to put up a big goal total. So really important game for them. And then Yale, Dartmouth played them tight. It was 3-3 with, you know, like 12 minutes to go in the second quarter, and then it was 10-3 at half. So it was very similar in that respect to what we saw against BU, where I believe that game was 5-5, and then it was 18-5. So, yeah.
And Yale's then they good. Woke up. Holy moly.
Yeah. And Princeton then subsequently held serve against the Terriers at home over the weekend. So, yeah, like I said, that's kind of how I see the Ivy League. And before we move on from that, shout out to Phil Kemp, whose brother Larkin was a standout long stick midi for that 2016 Brown Final Four team. I didn't see a clip of the play. Phil was a Yale hockey player and is now playing for the Bakersfield Condors, a minor league hockey team. And on Saturday night, apparently took a ugly hit into the boards, was stretchered off the ice, gave a thumbs up, leaving the arena. But I don't know how quickly it was clear that from a spinal and neurological standpoint, everything was going to be clear. He was discharged from the hospital on Sunday morning and made it home with the team. So that is very good news.
Yep. Just can't say enough good things about Larkin. He's been a good friend of mine since our first year for the Outlaws. And he's the kind of guy where it's like, you know, the pro career just really doesn't matter. So whenever I talk, I'm like, oh yeah, Larkin and I met on the Outlaws. I was like, well, how good was he? Well, neither of us were very good. We just were great friends, and the type of guy he is transcends lacrosse in every single way. So it was, you know, when we see something happen to his brother, that's a lacrosse community rallying point. So was really glad he was kind of keeping us updated in a group chat. So shout out Phil Kemp. Kemping ain't easy, but you make it look easier. You're tough as nails, and you got the entire lacrosse community's back. Or we have your back, sorry.
Can we talk about it for a sec?
About?
How easy or difficult Kemping is?
It you know, it seems not bad. If Kemping is... You know, Kemping ain't easy. I feel like...
What percentage of Kemping is tweeting at or about the NCAA president for his universally reviled aura and policies?
Which, first off, shout out Larkin Kemp for ending Emmert's career. Great job.
Second Mark.
Kempin seems pretty easy. Like, he'll send a picture into this group chat, and it's like him and his dad driving around somewhere in Connecticut in like some cool looking old timey car, and it'll be like, Kempin ain't easy. And I'm like, I want to try Kempin just so that I know how easy it is.
Correct. All right, Nick, your favorite part of the podcast. Notre Dame 16, Duke 15. Mercy rule is apparently somehow in effect. Give me something.
At what point do we just stop scheduling Duke for being too easy of an opponent? 16-15, but the real score, the adjusted score, was infinity to negative a trillion. Like, this Duke team, why are you even coming out of the locker room? Notre Dame is done pranking the country. We did it early in the season. Hey, let's make a wish and give Ohio State. Hey, let's let Maryland win by two. Ha ha, prank. Well, playtime's over. This Notre Dame team is the real deal. We're slapping around Syracuse. We're absolutely mercy ruling and humiliating Duke, taking down their pants and shoving them into a locker, giving him a swirly, all the classic pranks. Other than that, the only thing that I have to say, holy shit, the Notre Dame faceoff unit being a positive in an article about a victory is not something I expected to see in this young bald man's lifetime.
If only somebody off, on this podcast pointed to the fact that a freshman who was highly touted from a prominent high school program had the capacity to get better over the course of the season. I can't imagine anybody would ever say something like that.
Who was that?
Who said it, or who's the faceoff guy?
Who said it?
I said it.
Nah, we're going to need to see the tape. I don't believe it for a second. Yes. Credit to you for saying, hey, just hang in there and watch a freshman get better. And I said,
well, credit to Will Lynch because he's good.
Well, you know, but that's crediting a faceoff guy.
Oh, you hate doing that.
Yes. The only other thing is, like, this was, you know, if you had to write, and if we were stereotypical podcasters that were just saying the very obvious takes, it was almost too predictable, where if you were predicting what this game was going to be like last week or 2 weeks ago or even 3 weeks ago, you could have said, I can see this being a one-goal game with Duke kind of falling asleep in the first half and then waking up and making it a tight game. I don't know how, like, Brennan O'Neill just goes silent and then realizes that he's Brennan O'Neill and then has some ridiculous goals. I think he had a hat trick by the end of the game, which makes Duke all the more scary of an opponent. Like, what happens when they put a full four quarters together? They're one of the best teams in the country. But until they do that, they're a dumpster fire. I don't know. So,
I mean, no, you really just said everything you've said about Duke for the last 8 weeks in a seven sentence concise explanation. And I think that it's, I mean, no, I don't want to say weirdly accurate. There's very little about this, I think, that's like super surprising on the basis of what we've seen, right? This team is 9-5. Like, how bad is 9-5? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, they have three non-top 20 losses, which was, when I look at the top 20, like, that is to me the stat that stands out the most and is the most alarming and is potentially what would keep them out of the NCAA tournament. But it's very easily rectified by two more wins over the course of the regular season heading in, right? And I think when Carr talks about it on the broadcast and says, I see three ACC teams getting in, that's, I think, the only scenario. Like, we're going to talk about it in a second, but Virginia 11, Carolina 4, like, I don't see this Tar Heel resume coming together down the stretch in a way that's actually going to put them in a position to get in to the NCAA tournament. It's going to have to be Notre Dame, Duke, and Virginia.
I completely agree, and I'm not confident that if, you know, what ACC matchup outside of using Virginia, if they played 100 games, do you think would have the highest differential, like the highest percentage? What team in the ACC, Notre Dame, Syracuse?
Are you asking, like, if they played 100 games, which score differential would be biggest?
Yes, like which team
among the four teams that doesn't include Virginia?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, like,
Notre Dame, Cuse, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, I'm thinking about it from the standpoint of, like, if you ask, yeah, yes, that is what the answer is. That is, I think Notre Dame is the second best team. I think Syracuse is the fifth best team.
That's kind of like the way that I was trying to think about it, because, like, Duke, Carolina, Duke, Syracuse, Syracuse, UNC, Notre Dame, Duke, and even to an extent, Notre Dame, UNC, I'm like, I know there are better teams, but
Carolina is always close. Always. And Syracuse, Carolina is usually pretty close, too. So it really is Duke that has Carolina's number, at least, you know, whatever. I've been to a few close Duke, Carolina games, but this most recent one was not close. So, yeah, I would say that, like, on the basis of you look over the last 5 years and you look at the two teams right now, yeah, I would say it's pretty reasonable that Notre Dame and Syracuse represent the widest gap.
The widest gap
on a 17-year window is absolutely Duke over Virginia.
I mean, well, yeah, but that's not the question that I asked. So, all right, I'm just making sure we're on the same page because, again, just like we need the Ivy League to start crystallizing in the sense that, like, okay, teams need to start knowing that they're shitty, I'm a little worried where it's like, okay, I think things are clarifying a little bit for the ACC, but if one team, i.e. Notre Dame, slips up, that becomes a much tougher pitch if the Ivy League doesn't have things like that that Brown upset over Penn. So I'm already starting to do the scenarios, the math, and by math I mean strictly vibes. And I need UNC and Syracuse to suck, and I need Duke and Notre Dame to win out. Right.
So, Virginia obliged in their 11-4 victory over Carolina, a game in which it was really bizarre. So, the storyline coming into the game was that Matt Moore and Petey LaSala had sustained injuries against Richmond. Matt Moore pulled up with a hamstring right when he was on the ride, right before the midline, right before halftime. And then Petey LaSala, with like 3 minutes to go in the second quarter, got pushed from behind, fell awkwardly on his shoulder. I think that's where it was. It might have been from the check. Either way, if you'd asked me to diagnose it from the film, I would have thought he broke his collarbone. I would have thought that he was going to be done for 4 to 6 weeks. Would have thought Matt Moore was going to be done for 3 weeks, rehabbing a pulled hamstring. Well, Petey LaSala played. And not only did he play, but also both of Carolina's faceoff guys got hurt. Zach Tucci basically couldn't run. And Andrew Tyer got hurt in like the third quarter. So you would have thought they would have gone to Under-Armour All-American faceoff guy Chase Mullins, but they didn't. So not quite certain what's going on there. But either way, also not sure how much it matters because the Virginia defense was absolutely incredible, limiting Carolina to 4 goals scored, which when you got Chris Gray is not what you want to see.
And what a statement coming off of that embarrassing performance against Richmond from this Virginia defense. Correct. I don't know what to attribute it to as far as predictability and preparation of, like, okay, the very low-hanging fruit is, oh, we just got embarrassed because we didn't take this Richmond offense seriously. Now we need to double down against UNC. But at the same time, this UNC offense being held to 4 goals with a guy that's like, where is Chris Gray? He's number 2 right now?
All time in scoring?
Yeah.
I believe so. I believe he passed 3 guys this past weekend.
Yeah. There's a disconnect that is not making sense in my mind about this Virginia defense. And if I had to put a thumb in it, I was like, did they just have like their spring formal the day before the Richmond game? I don't know what happened, but to come out and hold UNC to 4 is like, that's as big of a statement as you can make. So bottom line, it's like, okay, Virginia's good. They just had to be reminded against a loss to Virginia. And I don't know who's going to take the field, the good Virginia or the bad Virginia. But I don't like that this type of I don't like that this is the top dog in the ACC because it makes everybody look bad.
So Lax Reference tweeted, I believe at Jules Henningberg's request, a graph that illustrated expected goals added on the x-axis, maybe it was on the y, and then on the x was usage. Chris Gray in this game had 3 goals and an assist, meaning that he either scored or assisted on every single goal. Cole Herbert had the other goal. Aside from Chris Gray, North Carolina shot 1 of 25.
Is that good? Would you describe that as good or bad in your professional opinion?
So the Tar Heels host Syracuse, who will be coming off short rest, having played Cornell on Monday. You want to play whose line is it to guess?
Whose line is it anyways? But with gambling?
Yes. How many goals would Syracuse need to be getting in order for you to take the orange at Chapel Hill, keeping in mind that they're playing a team that just shot 1 of 25 aside from Chris Gray?
Do they get the baked in excuse of, oh, our flight got in at 1 a.m. like they did against Notre Dame?
I have to read the DraftKings policy around delayed flights to know whether or not that cancels your bet.
I would need 3.5 goals. I think it's going to be UNC by 3.
All right.
And well, now it's your time. Don't just say all right without you proposing yourself.
I mean,
with the over-under being like 26.
Okay, so in that case, I'll take the under because I was thinking like 14-11. I could see that, but I think like the way that the game's actually going to unfold. No, I think the way the game's actually going to fold, I think Carolina's going to win like 12-7. Syracuse doesn't really play low-scoring games, though.
So you would need a 3.5 line as well?
No.
Or 4.5, sorry?
Yeah, I need 4.5, yeah. No. Well, I would need 5.5. I would need 5.5 in order to take Syracuse.
All right. Well, tell you what. Gentleman's wager. Whoever loses shaves their head.
I'm just thinking about how many times I'm going to be shaving my head over the course of the next month and a half. All right, Nick. Last game we're going to talk about. The Ohio State Buckeyes hosted the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays in what I think would essentially be described as the battle for third place in the Big Ten, with Maryland and Rutgers presumably the top two seeds. Jackson Reed, a midseason All-American midfielder, finished with 5 goals and assist. Jack Myers had a goal and 4 assists. And, you know, if you're a Blue Jay fan, I can imagine being disappointed because you had an opportunity to kind of grab this game by the scruff of the neck in the middle of the fourth quarter and it slipped through your fingers. But at the same time, like, for as disappointing as that is and for how nice it would be to be 6-6 right now, I'm not sure how much it matters because this is a team that's been AQ or bust for at least the last 3-4 weeks. So, you know, I think that there's a lot to be taken away from the fact that they were competitive against a top 10 team. And I don't know. I'm not somebody who thinks that Johns Hopkins is a birthright to be a good college lacrosse team. So, you know, from that end, I can hear complaints that we should hold ourselves to a standard higher than, you know, moral victories against good teams. But when you're losing to mediocre to bad teams, there's a lot to be said for playing a good team close.
You know, yes and no. This is more of a blemish on Ohio State than a good look. And you say, like, you know, the battle for the third place. I, without sounding too harsh, because, again, I do like the Hopkins coaching staff, I think it's Maryland, Rutgers, Ohio State, and then a cliff, and then everybody else trying to compete with those three teams. So credit to them for only losing 2 goals by 2 goals. But I honestly don't think this changes much. I don't think this was not a game where I was like anything other than, oh, that's closer than I would have expected, and then scrolling past it on my phone. So, you know, Ohio State getting smoked by Rutgers, and then their other losses to Denver. Who else?
Ohio State.
Top of your head, you know.
It's to Cornell. That was their first loss of the season.
Oh. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's.
Yeah, they don't have a bad loss.
No. Don't have a bad loss. I mean, their
worst that with their worst loss is Denver, and then their worst loss, their like actual like the poorest performance was when they got smoked by Rutgers.
Yeah, and then contrast that with Hopkins, who I mean, what would you class? I remember them losing to Delaware.
Yeah, they lost to they lost to Navy on a Friday and Delaware on a Saturday, and those are far and away their two worst losses.
Oh, that's tough. So I just think it's like, you know, I'm almost surprised you included this on the rundown because I just thought it was such a non-interesting, oh yeah, nothing changed at all. How about that? How's that for
you? There is nothing more antagonistic than saying, hey, I'm sorry that I just talked a bunch of trash about you, but if it makes you feel any better, I thought you were not relevant enough to talk trash about you in the first place.
Yeah. I listen, then prove me wrong. I the only other game I wanted to talk about was Vermont and UMass because Vermont scored 23. And anytime I see a 20 burger, I'm like, ha, got you good.
Yeah. Yeah, the CAA is crazy. Wait, it was UMass Lowell, not UMass.
UMass Lowell. Same thing. I'm from Denver, so UMass is UMass, regardless of what you put on as the accoutrement.
So when you go to a Colorado State game, is it just the same team? It's like an inter-squad scrimmage?
Oh, yeah. I have always – that's actually really funny you mention that because I've been calling it an inter-squad scrimmage, and I show up in Notre Dame gear, and everyone gets mad at me for it. I'm like,
Ralphie
hey,
is one of the cooler traditions in all of college sports. One of the biggest reasons – I mean, do you know whether Ralphie makes an appearance at any women's lacrosse games?
No, my assumption is no. But, you know, hey, maybe that's something. First off, that was the reason why I pulled for CU. And then when both of those programs went off a cliff, that's when I started making the inner squad joke.
Got it.
Which, again, everybody. God, it's so fun to be an elitist prick only to be the antagonist. Because all of my Denver friends. Oh, you know, you. I remember literally.
National championship in 1990, baby.
Yeah. And you were a CU fan. And I'm like, yeah. And then I grew up and hit puberty. You should try it, sweetie. Oh, man.
Just and then remember you start balding the year later?
Huh?
Did you start balding a year later?
Oh, no. This was, I think I was like 16, so I was well on my way. God damn it. Shut up, Terry.
Oh, it's only because I love you.
Thank you. I love you too.
All right, man. We'll talk to you next week. Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.